Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Pakistanis are preparing to go to the polls tomorrow, but the elections have been overshadowed by a sharp increase in the number of assassinations, bombings, and threats from the Taliban. In this piece, Bombing the Vote in Karachi, Rafi Azarakia writes, "In Karachi, the biggest city in the nation, producing from its cramped shops and strike-stricken streets the largest chunk of the country's GDP, there can be no campaigning. The talk in Karachi is all of terror, all of bombs, and all of fear." One newspaper reports details, dens of terrorist groups hidden in the industrial zones of the city. Shootouts erupt on street corners, and large crowds are just invitations to suicide bombers. No one has tears to spare for the 3, 4, 5, or 7 people killed in targeted shootings day after day. Rafi Azarakia is a columnist with Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper, and she's the author of the forthcoming book, The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. And she regularly reports from Pakistan. She's joining us now from New York. Hi, Rafia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined today by Jeremy Scahill. He's out with a new book called Dirty Wars. He takes us inside the United States' new covert wars operated by the CIA's Special Activities Division and the Joint Special Operations Command. He reports that the foot soldiers in these battles operate daily across the globe and even inside the U.S., with orders from the White House to do whatever is necessary to hunt down, capture, or kill individuals designated by the president as enemies. Jeremy Scahill is national security correspondent at The Nation magazine. He's author of the best-selling book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. His new book, Dirty Wars, just made the New York Times bestseller list. He's also producer and writer of the film Dirty Wars, which was selected for the U.S. documentary competition at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and it won the Cinematography Prize. It'll be in theaters next month. And Jeremy joins us here in studio. Hi, Jeremy. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Rafia, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I would like to recommend an article called Courage in Dangerous Times. And it appeared in Dawn, which is the newspaper that I write for that is published from Karachi, and it was by a female journalist named Naziha Sayed Ali. And it featured a profile of a woman and a doctor who is contesting elections from Quetta in Pakistan. And the reason why I thought it was good is because this woman, Dr. Hashmi, belongs to a minority Shia community in Quetta, and she's also minority in terms of being a woman. And she is contesting elections despite the fact that just in the past 2 weeks, Quetta has seen over 10 bomb blasts.
Wow.
And her campaign has been severely impacted by that. And, I just wanted to give a shout-out to that article because it does represent the resilience of Pakistanis, and especially Pakistani women, at a time, a very difficult time for the country and for her community.
And thank you for that. We'll put a link to that piece right after our show today. And we'll also talk about what's happening in Pakistan and the increasing violence in just a couple minutes. What about you, Jeremy? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, I thought that there was a really fantastic piece written by a wonderful journalist named Iona Craig, who is a freelance reporter based in Yemen. And she reports for the Times of London and a number of other outlets. But she wrote a story for the Index on Censorship about a journalist that I've written a lot about, and his story is told in my book, named Abdullah Haider Shaya. And he's a Yemeni journalist who exposed a U.S. cruise missile attack against Yemen in December of 2009. It was the first time that President Obama authorized a strike, a military strike against Yemen during his presidency, and it killed 46 people. 14 of them were women and 21 were children. And this incredibly brave Yemeni journalist exposed that strike, and he was ultimately arrested by Yemen's secret police and put on trial for being an al-Qaeda facilitator. And, you know, I've talked to all sorts of people, major international journalists. No one believes that he has anything to do with terrorism, that he's an actual real journalist. And people can read the about him in my book. But what Iona did is to report this week that well, first of all, you have to understand he was put in prison, and then the Yemeni government was going to pardon him because of tremendous pressure from basically every major human rights organization in the world called for his release. And there was a lot of pressure within Yemen. the government was going to pardon him, and President Obama personally called the dictator of Yemen and said that the U.S. is concerned about reports that he's going to be released from prison. And so that journalist remains in prison because President Obama wants him there. And so there was a report that came out in the Yemeni press a couple of days ago saying that the new president of Yemen, Hadi, is going to release Abdullah Haider Shaya. And Iona Craig looks at whether or not Obama is going to call again to keep Abdullah Haider Shaya in prison. It's an outrageous case. And, you know, the very last line of my book in the acknowledgments is that he's still in prison and that he should be set free.
And so is there still a strong campaign in Yemen?
Absolutely. I mean, he is a household name in Yemen. There are posters in the Yemeni capital demanding that he be released from prison. And, you know, I've heard from his family members that he's losing his mind. You know,
wow.
They have him in a cell in solitary confinement. You know, this was a guy who was an incredibly brave journalist who was interviewing leaders of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He did numerous interviews with Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen who was killed in a drone strike, and he exposed U.S. cruise missile attacks. And if you go back and look at his reporting, he was very confrontational with the al-Qaeda people that he interviewed. He was a fiercely independent journalist. And, you know, Iona and I both have been deeply involved with trying to get him freed, and also to ask the White House to produce any evidence that this guy has anything to do with al-Qaeda except interviewing them as a journalist, which we should be doing.
How long has he been in jail?
He's been in jail now for about 3 years.
He
was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
Do you know how old he is?
I think he's, you can check his Wikipedia page. I want to say he's in his early 30s.
So he's a young journalist.
He is, yeah.
3 years, losing his mind.
There's this chilling, in our movie that we made, we tell historian, and we have this video when he's pulled into this court. He was taken into a court that was set up specifically to prosecute journalists for committing crimes against the dictatorship in Yemen, a total kangaroo court. And they bring him into the courtroom, and, you know, it's a chilling story. He refused to present a defense. And he said, told his lawyers, I don't want you to even respond. I don't want to dignify this court by having lawyers represent me. I'm not going to respond to their charges in their, you know, in their court. They bring him into a cage into this courtroom. And we have a video where he's in this cell, and all these security officers are holding him. And he's saying, the reason that I'm in prison is for exposing the American cruise missile attack on a Bedouin village that killed innocent women and children. This is what happens when you do real journalism in Yemen.
And the decision should come down soon about
fate? Well, apparently there's already been an order issued, although the family says they haven't heard any word of it. But the official statement from the Yemeni president is that he issued a decree saying that he should be freed. He has not yet been freed. I would imagine that the White House is deeply involved with trying to keep him in prison. And I mean, he very well may stay in prison, but I hope not. I hope he does get freed.
Well, we'll follow that and hopefully bring on a journalist from Yemen in the coming months. And
there are some great ones there, too.
Yeah, I'll get a recommendation after the show. That's Jeremy Scahill, author of the new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And Rafia, let's talk about what is happening in Pakistan. And since you both brought up, you know, journalists in Pakistan and Yemen, first of all, just give us an overview. What is the state of journalism like in Pakistan?
Well, first of all, I'd like to emphasize Jeremy's point, which I think he makes brilliantly in his book. And one of the, I think, crucial things that he underlines about Shay's case is that here's a journalist that wanted to expose both sides of the story. He was showing how the U.S. is operating illegally and condemning people without process. And then he was also showing how the Yemeni government is in cahoots with various parts of the U.S. government, including in targeting people. And I think that is an essential part of the story in Yemen and in Pakistan, where if you're trying to put the facts out there, where you're showing you're not taking a side, and you're showing, you know, how both the Pakistani government as well as the U.S. government is failing ordinary people and their citizens, you essentially condemn yourself from both sides. And, you know, you face criticism and scrutiny on either side. So I think that's actually a really, really important point when considering Pakistan as well. And, you know, you asked me about the state of journalism in Pakistan. I think that Pakistani journalists face tremendous obstacles. They've had a huge number of them have been killed. An editor at Dawn, is the newspaper that I work for, was killed last year. And there have been, you know, innumerable deaths. But those are just obviously the people who die. At the same time, you face threats both from Islamists and extremists who perceive newspapers, especially English newspapers, as liberal. On the other hand, you face, pressure both from the government as well as from authorities if you're publishing things that they don't like. So, in those terms, Pakistani journalists face incredible odds in terms of trying to report stories that deserve to be brought before the public, but that, are trying to be covered up for various reasons. In light of the election, of course, all of these factors have come forward. The media is trying very hard to get the vote out, to encourage people to be at the polls, to believe in the democratic process. But at the same time, as you quoted from my article, there's huge swaths of the country that are kind of alienated from the campaigning process. Karachi, the city that I'm from, is one of those places where it's very, very dangerous to campaign, to have any kind of a public rally. I spent all morning talking to friends and family in Karachi, and you really hear mixed feelings and a lot of apprehension about whether you should go and vote tomorrow because of the danger to ordinary people. Because so many extremist groups have already very clearly, very brazenly said that they're going to attack polling stations.
And Rafia, Jeremy writes about drone strikes in his book. And, this gets coverage in the U.S. on a fairly regular basis, but a lot of reporters say they're having a hard time getting information. We'll talk with Jeremy about that later in the show. But how significant are these drone strikes, which are very unpopular, obviously, in Pakistan, in the rise of the Taliban and the destabilization of the country?
There's several levels and several dimensions to the drone strikes. One is, of course, as you mentioned, the immediate impact to the populations where they're carried out. And it's not just American journalists, but also Pakistani journalists who face obstacles in trying to get into the regions and see exactly what the impact of the strike is in terms of civilian casualties, in terms of property damage, and all of that. But the larger story that I've tried to emphasize in my writing has been twofold. The first is, just even the effectiveness of drone strikes. I mean, last year, which is like the fifth intense year of drone strikes in Pakistan, there were 652 bombings in Pakistan. 652. Just last year. And the reason I emphasize that number is because the equation as far as drones are concerned is being sold that drones are like this precision solution to terrorism. And the question is that if drones, and this is, the fifth year of intense droning of Pakistan, are so effective, as the U.S. government claims, then how on earth have these various motley crew of groups that are being attacked, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, what have you, how on earth are they able to carry out 652 terrorist bombings in Pakistan? So obviously these claims about killing the leadership, about decimating them, about reducing their capabilities are not true, because not only have they the bombings increased in number over the years, but they've also expanded their geographical space. I mean, it used to be that a lot of Taliban activity was limited to the tribal areas in the northwest of Pakistan. Now there's been report after report on how you quoted my article as well, on various how the Taliban have basically relocated in parts of Karachi, in Quetta, where the drones can't get them, and where it's very, very easy to destabilize. Karachi is the biggest city in Pakistan. When the Taliban carry out these operations in Karachi, they're able to bring this city of 18 million people to a standstill. The city produces 60% of the country's GDP. So shutting down Karachi is like shutting down Pakistan, and that's what they're able to do. So that's an important piece of the drone war that really Americans they don't see the domino effect of these drone strikes. First, they've just essentially moved the theater of conflict from the northwest of the country into the country's major urban areas. The other is, you know, the question of displacement and endangering local populations. I mean, you've had no one in Pakistan is counting because the number of people that are displaced because of the drone strikes and have relocated in various other parts of the country. The reason why that's important is because Pakistan is an ethnically divided country, and the lines between ethnic populations have been drawn after much conflict. So if you move one ethnic group into another ethnic group's area, there's civil war, and that's what you see happening in Karachi. The Pashtun population in Karachi has increased, and now there's a turf war going on between the party that controls Karachi and the new incoming people. I mean, the point being is that, you know, it's really a complete fallacy to say that drone strikes are in any way precision-oriented or accurate, because what they're doing is destabilizing, or what they have done is destabilize an entire country and change the population patterns, change the migration patterns, change the conflict patterns. And so you have a situation where now, Pakistanis should have been very happy about the fact that this is, the first time they're having a transition of government through elections. But instead, they're facing a situation where election campaigning can really only take place in one, the Punjab province, and maybe half of another Sindh province. But in the other parts of the country, it's simply too dangerous to actually go out and campaign, participate in rallies, or do any of the sort of things that voters should be free and able to do before making their decision.
And Rafia, before we let you go, Jeremy, I was wondering if you had any questions for Rafia, who goes back and forth between New York and Pakistan. And because of her reporting, she has received death threats.
Yeah, I mean, I admire her for having the courage to do this. I always say, you know, when people ask me, aren't you concerned about your safety? Or people will say, oh, you're so brave for doing this. And I always get embarrassed when people say that, because the real heroes doing the reporting are people that are local and live in country. And a lot of them, we don't know their name and they're not famous. And when bad things happen to them, there's not outcry. You know, when Richard Engel was briefly held in Syria, it was like, you know, it was like leading all the newscasts. And it was this, you know, he did all these interviews about his time being held. You know, there are journalists that have been missing in Syria for over a year. There are journalists that are getting murdered on a regular basis in Mexico, murdered in Somalia, put in prison in Yemen or Pakistan. And so the real heroes are the reporters who don't have the sort of ability to get back on an airplane and fly back to Park Slope, Brooklyn, where I live. And, so I always get embarrassed at that, because, you know, I parachute in and then leave. The real heroes are the people that make my journalism possible. And that's why my acknowledgments in my book are 3,000 words long, because I wanted to thank all of the journalists that make it possible to do this kind of work.
Yeah, I would really like to second that, especially, you know, the people I work with. Like I said, I mean, like Jeremy, I mean, I don't live in country full time, but the staff at Dawn, I mean, they have to go through so many metal detectors, so much security just to get in the building, because they are under so much threat all the time. And so I really want to salute the editors, the journalists in Pakistan who are out there reporting, and especially dangerous in these in terrorist incidents, because, as you know, in most cases in Pakistan, there's one bomb blast, and then reporters go to report on it, and often there's another bomb blast. And a lot of reporters have lost their lives, and cameramen have lost their lives in those sorts of double blasts. And so, if anything, if we, you know, talk about the media, we really should understand just how hard these people work, how little they're paid, and how brave they are in bringing these stories to the world. And I would encourage your listeners to go to the website of Dawn, which is an English newspaper in Pakistan, so that they can get a bit of the story from the Pakistani perspective, so that you can really see what the Pakistani people are experiencing at this time.
Well, Rafia, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have you back soon to talk about the elections.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rafia. Stay safe.
Yes, stay safe. That's Rafia Zakaria, columnist with Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Pakistani journalist Samira Shackle recently wrote, quote, "Last year I did some work with Dawn, and entering their offices in Karachi involved multiple metal detectors, bomb detectors, and bag searches because the Taliban had directly threatened media groups over negative coverage," end quote. And in Jeremy Scahill's new book, Dirty Wars, he dedicates it to journalists, those imprisoned for doing their jobs and those who have died in pursuit of the truth. And Jeremy is out with this new massive book that is, with the notes, just over 600 pages. You know, Jeremy, in this book, you've got sort of small sections, and there are 57 of these. Mm-hmm. And you report from Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and beyond. And, I mean, we had you on when you wrote Blackwater, and I'm just wondering, when did this journey begin for you?
Well, you know, I sort of grew up at Democracy Now, at Amy Goodman's show, and I started as a coffee runner there. I begged my way into a highly unpaid experience, having Amy Goodman as my mentor, and I immediately was taken with the idea of, I mean, I loved radio journalism. I loved this idea that you were painting this picture that people wouldn't see, and you were doing it through sound. And I loved, early on, sort of my specialty was that I was doing these unnarrated montages, and I would go to demonstrations or meetings, and I would create these sort of audio packages that told their own story. And I started doing international stuff when Amy took me to Nigeria with her in 1998, and we did a documentary about the Chevron Oil Corporation's role in targeting activists who were protesting against environmental destruction in their community. And soon after that, I went to Iraq. And you know, lest you think it's like I have this sort of huge cash fund that I can hop around the world, I spend a lot of my time begging for money. But I begged enough money to get a plane ticket and went over with a humanitarian delegation that was going into Iraq in 98. And I fell in love with that country. And I really saw my role for the first half of my life as a journalist. You know, I really saw my role as putting a microphone in front of people who had no voice and who lived on the other side of the barrel of the gun of U.S. foreign policy. And I didn't really get into anything of an investigative journalism nature until I started working on the Blackwater story. I mean, much of what I was doing was trying to tell the stories of people affected by U.S. policy around the world. And I got on the Blackwater story because I was down in New Orleans in the aftermath of the flooding of the city during Hurricane Katrina, and met these Blackwater guys on the streets, you know, wielding M4 assault rifles and Glock 9 pistols. And from that day that I met them to stepping into your studio today, I've lived in this sort of world of exploring the sort of shadow forces within the U.S. national security apparatus. And I've met a tremendous array of characters, some of whom are Navy SEAL snipers. I've become friends with a guy who's the former senior SEAL sniper at the Naval Special Warfare Group, and he took me flying in his plane the other day. We flew off out of Santa Monica Airport to Catalina Island, and he was doing all of these dogfighting maneuvers. But, you know, he and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, but I really have come to... you know, I always tell people that we need to humanize the victims of U.S. war. And for me, part of my own personal journey in this was humanizing the people that are fighting those wars to understand where they're coming from. And so I think people will be surprised at some of the stories in this book. This is not a rhetorical, polemical book at all.
Right. And when we do shows about military, I mean, a lot of people within the military really want to get at the real picture. They talk about the fact that there is so much waste, that we do need to speak out about things like drones. And so we will talk about that after the break, about people who actually contacted you to give you information that a lot of journalists don't have access to. And then I'd also love to talk with you about how this whole experience has really shaped your views about how the media actually works. We're speaking with Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. What questions and comments do you have about war reporting? And what questions do you have about for Jeremy about his overall journey? We'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in the Your Call weekly email newsletter. The newsletter is free and easy to sign up for. Just click the link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, or send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about moms organizing, various groups of mothers organizing for a healthier country for children, wages, equality, you name it. So we'll talk about success stories on Monday. Tuesday, we're going to talk about Made in California, a new bill that would focus on things made in California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we are joined by Jeremy Scahill. He's out with a new book, Dirty Wars: The World is a Battlefield. He takes us inside the United States' new covert wars operated by the CIA's Special Activities Division and the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC. He reports that the foot soldiers in these battles operate daily across the globe and even in the U.S. with orders from the White House to do whatever is necessary to capture, hunt down, or kill individuals designated by the president as enemies. And Jeremy will be talking about his book tonight at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, 2501 Harrison Street at 27th Street. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions for Jeremy about his journey and his reporting to places like Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, and beyond, just overall questions about war reporting, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So we've got a couple emails coming in about drones, but before we do that, I mean, how has this experience really shaped your opinions of war reporting? Because you've actually been able to kind of penetrate the machine. I mean, you go on MSNBC on a regular basis. I think Lou Dobbs had you on at one point on CNN. So, I mean, it's a big question.
Yeah, that was surreal.
Yeah, I'm sure. We'll talk about that throughout the show. But just because, you know, you've had access to a lot of these people, Jake Tapper, who's now on CNN, you know, people sort of slam the corporate media with this broad brush. But what are your thoughts about war reporting in the year 2013?
I mean, you know, I think it's important to point out that there are incredibly fantastic reporters working for large corporate media outlets. And I think a lot of times there's a tendency to sort of say, well, the corporate media doesn't cover this. There are some great reporters. Charlie Savage is a fantastic reporter for The New York Times. Michelle Shepard is an incredible reporter for the Toronto Star. She's one of the best war reporters in the world. And she has additional risks that she faces being a woman traveling in a lot of these countries. And she's just a phenomenally brave, smart reporter who I really admire. You know, and C.J. Chivers, also for The New York Times, another amazingly brave reporter. There was this young guy, Austin Tice, who was a former Marine who wanted to be a journalist and was working for McClatchy. And he was writing these incredible stories from Syria, and he went missing, and he's still missing. And I've tried to work to call for his release. We believe that he's being held by the Assad regime's forces, not by rebel groups. And, you know, I bring that up because, you know, I spend much of my time with unfamous, unembedded reporters from other countries, and we don't know their work because they're not reporting in English, you know, or the stories are off the U.S. radar. You know, we have a kind of infotainment culture and a short attention span culture. And I mean, I love Twitter, and I think it's an amazing tool, but it's a two-edged sword. You know, there's also a lot of blah 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 on, you know, online. You know, you ask about the state of war reporting. You know, what I was saying earlier, I think that we have to create a culture within journalism where those of us that do have access to big media, whether it's me getting invited on these shows or it's people who write for these big corporate media outlets, that when our unfamous non-American colleagues get into trouble, that we're there to defend them and to stand up for them. And we were talking about Abdullah Haider Shaya earlier, this Yemeni journalist who's in prison. He did work for NBC News, The Washington Post, ABC News, Not a single one of those news organizations have said anything about his imprisonment. It's shameful. They should be ashamed of themselves. When he was giving them sensational stories, interviews with Anwar al-Awlaki after the underwear bomber, you know, he did this interview with al-Awlaki that was incredible. It was a very confrontational interview. NBC ran it. ABC ran it. The Washington Post excerpted it. You know, so when he's there risking his life to bring them stories that are exclusives and scoops, they love it. But then when he gets in trouble and they say, oh, he's al-Qaeda, silence. I was told by someone from one of those networks, and I'm not going to say who, that he was told by senior U.S. officials that the money that they were paying Abdulelah Haider Shaya, which I'm sure was a pittance, was going to fund al-Qaeda, and that the U.S. has evidence that he was involved with plots to attack foreign embassies. I mean, it's just scurrilous that they wouldn't do it. So, I mean, I always try to use when I take it every time I get invited on one of those shows, I just assume it's the last time I'm going to be on. And I try to make some point that I think is not generally permitted on those networks.
Well, this one point that I was kind of cheering for you when I saw you do this, and a lot of people tweeted about it. You were on MSNBC September 9th of last year, and you said that the network was basically their foreign policy coverage felt like an Obama for America meetup.
I was talking about their coverage of the Democratic National Convention, and to me it looked like there was nothing that would distinguish MSNBC's coverage from an Obama house party that night, where everyone's just rah-rah and cheerleading, and there was this sort of hyper nationalism and spiking the football of killing Osama bin Laden. And I said it on their own on their network. And I actually, one of their famous hosts sent me a private note saying, look at you biting the hand that feeds, attacking us on our own airwaves. And I wrote back and said, you've never paid me anything. You're not the hand that feeds me. And I'm not going to cater my politics just because I happen to be on your show. I mean, if it's true, it's true. And it's, you know.
And you have been invited back.
I have been invited back. It's strange. You know, I think Chris Hayes does really the best show that's on corporate television. I think I was sad to see his weekend show go, because I thought Up with Chris Hayes was some of the smartest talk ever heard on corporate television. You know, he's got this primetime show now that I think is good, but I really thought he was able to do stuff like you do on this show, where Amy Goodman does on Democracy Now, where you have real conversations. And, you know, he was one of the only hosts that had true representation of communities of color, voices of women that are, you know, seldom heard, including on national security issues, where there are women that are working on this as their beat. They almost never get interviewed on it. So, I think it's a mixed bag. You know, I think Chris Hayes does some great stuff, and I think there's a lot of silly season that goes on. MSNBC, we can beat up on them, but you know, Fox is like a parody of itself. You know, when you watch it, and then CNN is just, I don't know anyone that watches CNN, so it's I think Jake Tapper is a fantastic journalist and one of the few journalists that asked real tough questions when he was at the White House for ABC News, going after both Bush and Obama.
We're speaking with Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Hana calling from the East Bay. Hi, Hana. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Jeremy. I hope you can hear me okay.
Yep.
So I had a question for Jeremy. You've been embedded with all these reporters in their countries. I'm wondering, how big is the gap, really, between our reporting here about, you know, what happens in those countries versus their own reporting about, you know, the events that happen in overseas in their countries? How big is that gap, really, if there is a gap at all? Thanks.
There's a tremendous gap. I mean, part of what's happening, you know, I mean, I don't mean to just make the whole show about this journalist in Yemen who's in prison, but what happened after he was put in prison is that it sent a chill through the journalism community in Yemen. And the U.S. ambassador, Gerald Feierstein, said, you know, well, if journalists are not involved with al-Qaeda, then they have nothing to fear. I think journalists should be involved with al-Qaeda to the extent that they are talking to them, because if we're being told that these are the enemy, we should be covering them. We should be interviewing them. I mean, I've sat down and talked to people that the United States wants killed. And are they going to, you know, should I be put in prison for that? Or is that something responsible? I mean, if I were in the CIA, and I don't like to give advice to the empire on how to run its affairs, but if I were in the CIA, I would want someone like Abdulelah Haider Shaya out there interviewing these people, because we actually would understand something about their mentality. Mm. We have a cartoonish version of who a lot of these groups, these Islamist groups are around the world, and we need real journalism. So there is a big disconnect. A lot of the major corporate outlets that are reporting from these countries are doing it. It's sort of like, you know, hotel and taxi journalism. You know, if I have to read one more column about what Thomas Friedman's concierge said or his taxi driver said, you know, I'm going to go and shave his mustache off myself by force. But, you know, but I think that, you know, the caller raises a good point. I think there's a major disconnect.
So let's talk a little bit about, you said earlier you're this parachute journalist. Talk a little bit about what happens when you go to a place you've never been before. How do you actually start to find this information and then gain the trust and then find the local journalists, because those are the people that actually help you do this work?
Right. I mean, I'll tell you one interesting story, or I think it might be interesting. When I went to Somalia, you know, at the time, Somalia is constantly in flux. I mean, there's a period right now where I think there's the first real hope in Somalia for a long time that things could change. And there's a lot of diaspora Somalis that are coming back. And I mean, I think about it every day because, you know, my friends and colleagues there, I Skype with them regularly. And my buddy Bashir, who was the one that kept me alive in Bashir Osman, kept me alive in Somalia. He and I were Skyping one day, and he was talking about how this new restaurant had opened right on the ocean. And he was excited about that. And then the very next day, there was this massive attack on a court in Mogadishu, and 20 something people were killed. And then there was a suicide bombing that went off at the gates of the Ministry of Education. And, you know, it's a sort of painful thing. I mean, Somalis have suffered so tremendously, really since, you know, the early 1990s. And I think all that Americans know about Somalia for the most part is Black Hawk Down or starving babies, you know, pictures. And Somalia has a rich history, and the U.S. has been deeply involved with destabilizing that country and funding warlords and others. So when I was looking at going there, you know, it took me about 3 or 4 months of planning. And I talked with a lot of journalists, Catherine Horold, who's another fantastic journalist who was worked for the AP for a long time in Nairobi. She's now in Pakistan working for Reuters. She's a fantastic journalist. She was really, really helpful in putting me in touch with reliable people. And I ended up finding, you know, someone who really could get me in and out of there safely. But when we flew into Adenade Airport in Mogadishu, you know, there was massive fighting in the city at the time. The local Al-Qaeda affiliate, Al-Shabaab, was in control of more than half of the capital, and there were gun battles between U.S.-backed warlords and these Al-Qaeda factions, and there were African Union troops backed by the United States and funded and armed. And so we go into that city. Well, if you're not careful, if you don't have a real plan, you get kidnapped within 5 minutes of leaving the airport. So, and you also want to make sure that you don't endanger the local journalists that you're working with, because people think I'm CIA. It happens to me all the time. I mean, these warlords were like trying to renew their contracts with me, and I'm like, buddy, you got the wrong guy. I'm not in the CIA. Google me. You know, I'm the furthest thing from the CIA that's ever sat in front of, furthest white man from the CIA that's ever sat with you. But he did. He said, you know, your intelligence, and part of it was sort of a veiled threat. I mean, I think he was you know, implying that if he wanted to, he could just take me out.
In your book, again, it's over 550 pages when you don't count the resources, but there's so much information and you dig so deeply. And as you said, you know, so many Americans don't know much about Somalia. You know, a lot of people can't even explain what's happening in Israel, Palestine. So how do you connect the dots with all of this that's happening? Because you might lose people, right? The further down you go, people are eyes glazed over, like, what do I do with this information?
Yeah.
And as you said, we have a crisis of conscience because so many liberals have been mostly silent about what President Obama is doing. So when you step back and you look at all this reporting that you've done, how do you really connect these dots?
Yeah, well, first of all, when you were talking before about how I have the 57 or 58, you know, chapters of the book, I tried to write it like a novel where there were short chapters and weaving different stories in and out so that it didn't feel like you were doing homework and that they're actual. I tried to create characters that could tell these stories that were recurring characters. And I think that's a big part of the problem, is that a lot of us can feel overwhelmed by the facts or by the reality. And I think storytelling is such an important part of change. And if you know, good storytellers can move you and can help you to see a picture you've been staring at, you know, for your whole life in a very different way, if they tell you a different way of looking at it and do it through storytelling. You know, I think that a lot of liberals want to believe that Obama was the character that they conjured up in their head during the campaign. You know, and I think people genuinely wanted an end to the excesses and abuses. I mean, I certainly did of the Bush era. And I think there are cracks in the armor right now. I think people are starting to realize that those of us who were saying this is sort of much of the same when it comes to a lot of the foreign policy decisions, like it's a continuation, that there's truth to it. And I think that part of the problem is that because Obama is a constitutional, law professor by trade, won the Nobel Peace Prize, brought down the Republicans and put himself into office with all this enthusiastic support, that he's been able to kind of be a very effective salesman for empire building. I think somewhere Cheney is probably sitting and fly fishing somewhere in the back of his head thinking, well, I'm actually glad that this Obama guy was in office, because when Rubio comes into office or Jeb Bush or whoever comes next, they're going to be able to say to liberals, you can't go after us on these issues because you were enthusiastically backing it when your guy was doing it. And I think I think we're going to look back on this and I think people will realize, maybe not for a while, but I think they will realize that that this administration really solidified some of the worst policies of the Bush era as a permanent bipartisan fixture.
We're speaking with Jeremy Scahill, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine, about his new book, Dirty Wars: The World is a Battlefield. The film by the same name will be out next month, and Jeremy is talking about his book tonight at 7:30 at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, 2501 Harrison at 27th. And we've got just about 10 minutes left, so if you'd like to join us, if you have questions for Jeremy about his reporting, about his experiences, about the overall nature of war reporting, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Art in San Francisco who says, Jeremy, do you think that the tide of U.S. public opinion on drones is turning negative? The drumbeat of opposition to drones seems to be growing. Just today, he noticed two items. One, a New York Times op-ed, How to Generate Distrust on Drones, and it blasts the secrecy of U.S. drone policy, and cites a former U.S. State Department legal advisor.
Harold Coe, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Who says that must end. And then today on NPR's Morning Edition, former Air Force pilot has cautionary tales about drones, featuring the misgivings of a drone pilot about killing via remote control.
Well, I mean, Harold Coe was the former dean of the Yale Law School, and he was the senior State Department advisor who signed off on a lot of these strikes, including strikes that killed dozens of women and children. And, I'm glad that Harold Coe is speaking out now that he's out of office. But it would have been better if Harold Coe actually fought this battle, when he was in a position of authority. And that, it's easy to come out of government and then criticize it. And I don't want to minimize how important it is to have those voices. But, I have a little bit of a problem with Harold Coe's line, because, the whole issue is about it being transparent and providing the rationale or reasons for it. But it doesn't fundamentally question whether we should be assassinating people around the world. But I do agree with the caller that for the first time in 12 years, we are actually having a discussion. There have been two hearings in the past month on drones on Capitol Hill, one of which had a young Yemeni guy who I know, Fadaya al-Muslimi, testify. His village had been bombed 6 days before he testified in front of the Senate. I'm hearing from people in the intelligence community that there is internal pushback from CIA analysts over the what's called the signature strike policy, where they're killing people whose identities we don't know simply because we suspect they may be terrorists, and they're military age males in certain regions of Pakistan and Yemen. But then you had the Rand Paul filibuster of the Brennan nomination, which was, 2/3 crazy and 1/3 sane. And I didn't do I Stand with Rand, because I don't stand with Rand. I think he's a nutcase. But I think that he happened to be very sane on this issue for part of that day and should be given credit for that, because the Democrats certainly haven't been standing up and talking about why, we need to know why U.S. citizens are being put on a kill list instead of charged with crimes.
Isn't Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon is one of the few, right?
Wyden is good. I mean, yes. Ron Wyden has been tenacious on the issue of transparency and trying to have the administration put forward its rationale for particularly targeting U.S. citizens. But also he's challenged the interpretation of laws in secret by the White House. He told me when I interviewed him, that Ron Wyden recently, it's almost as though there are two laws in America. There is the public law that you can read, and most reasonable people would interpret it the same way. And then there is the secret interpretation of the very same laws, like the Patriot Act, by the administration. And he said that if you could see the difference between the two of them, you would be shocked. And I said, but you can't disclose the difference between the two of them. And he says, that's correct, because he's a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He can't. So he's been very good. But we need at least 10 or 15 Ron Wydens with a little bit of either Russ Feingold Elder Denis Kucinich so that they take it a step further? I mean, Wyden is a very respectful dissident from this policy within the within the U.S. government.
And both of those guys are gone now.
Well, yeah, Kucinich got redistricted. Russ Feingold is, you know, I mean, I'm from Milwaukee, and, you know, Feingold is now teaching at Marquette Law School in Milwaukee. And there are rumblings that Feingold might be appointed some kind of an envoy for the Obama administration. You know, I mean, what's remarkable is you sort of don't realize how good someone is until they're gone in a lot of cases. I mean, Russ Feingold was an incredibly rare character for the Senate. I mean, the only senator that voted against the Patriot Act. I in the course of researching this book, I went back and, you know, Feingold was one of the few people in the Senate that understood U.S. policy in Somalia and understood the impact of overthrowing the only stable government Somalia had had in decades when the U.S. partnered with the Ethiopian military to overthrow the government of the Islamic Courts Union in 2006-2007. Just a multidimensional, brilliant guy on foreign policy. I mean, I think it would be great if Feingold tried to run for president one day. I mean, I'm not a Democrat at all, but I would actually consider, you know, quitting journalism to go and work on the Feingold campaign, because I think he's a real smart, strategic thinker. I have problems with some of his policies, but he's an unusual character in American politics.
Well, thanks for the email, Art. Let's go next to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Thank you. You know, Jeremy Scahill, before we elect Mr. Feingold, let's think for a moment of a question or a predicament you posed a few moments ago when you said that you can take a constitutional lawyer by training and put him in the White House, and this is how he behaves. He solidifies the previous regime. Well, then this might pose a question that we should be asking, or maybe you know somebody who's already asking it. Is there something wrong? Is there a malady or some kind of a condition in the White House? Like, I'm sure it's not sick building syndrome, but is there something about our system of governance, about the presidency, which has about it a kind of illness that we should be examining that takes over the character of the person who's elected to office, so that no matter who it is, we're going to see this. We're going to turn the grinder and the pablum's going to come out. What do you think? Is there a malady or some condition that seems to take over no matter what the other expectations might be for the candidate who wins the office?
Yeah, you know, I was speaking at a conference on drones, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago, and Ralph Nader was in the just came as an audience member, and he was there, and he got up at one point and he sort of was giving me trouble about my choice of words, and said, you know, ask me point blank, you know, is Barack Obama a war criminal? And you know, and I you know, I mean, I respect Ralph Nader quite a bit, and I think that he gets smeared so often, and people blame him for, you know, the Bush election what happened in Florida in 2000, and I think that it's just a sort of scurrilous smear campaign against him, and he's an important voice in our society. But when he asked me that, you know, and I took it as seriously as a question. I mean, of course, the answer is yes. It comes with the office. There, I don't know of any president who hasn't been, hasn't done things that constitute war crimes within like days of assuming office. Obama bombed Pakistan his third day in office, and it killed a number of women and children. If the U.S. was actually a signatory to the International Criminal Court and believed that international justice should be applied evenly, not just for the Miloševiches of the world or the butchers of Rwanda, but actually evenly, then we'd live in a different society. But as long as we have a two-party system in this country with huge corporate cash just infecting every aspect of our politics and buying politicians, nothing will fundamentally change. I mean, even if someone like Russ Feingold were to win, it would only be a slight move in the right direction. I don't think he would be a transformative figure at all. It's just that I think that he, on the issues I work on, I think it would be kind of awesome to see the ideas that he would come up with. But I don't have any faith that that anyone that would achieve the office of presidency would be anything other than a hawk.
We have another question from a listener who says, you're saying that reporters should talk to Al-Qaeda. Does that put you at risk from the U.S. government in relation to the NDAA?
Yeah, of course. That's what the issue is.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what are your comments on Chris Hedges' lawsuit?
No, I support it. I mean, I think, they had asked me to work on that lawsuit, and I have serious concerns about that, and I'm glad that they're doing it. But I wasn't able to review all of the facts of it because I was so busy. But I mean, I've spoken in support of them. I think it's the right thing to do. I mean, You have a situation where the government is asserting its authority to indefinitely detain Americans. And, you know, people like Chris or me or a lot of reporters, we are in touch with people that are considered enemies of the United States because we're doing our job as journalists. And, you know, I think we all make a mistake of saying, you know, it can't happen here. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, people try to make it sound like a conspiracy theory. They would never do this. Well, you know, go back through history. It starts somewhere, you know, and I'm, you know, not to be too much of an alarmist, but I do think that we have to hold the line, you know, wherever we can. We already live in an atmosphere where civil liberties are under attack. And I think we can't let them take more from us.
In terms of precedent, I mean, one of your main arguments is that President Obama has amplified some of the most contentious foreign policy operations pursued under the Bush administration. What sort of precedent does this set? I mean, this is something we don't really read much about in the media.
Well, I think that, you know, I think because it's a popular Democratic president, you know, a lot of liberals are supporting these policies because it's a very short-sighted, largely partisan, or the sort of cult of Obama rationale for doing it. But I think there's been a continuum in U.S. foreign policy going back decades. It's not, you know, Clinton was a very hawkish president. A lot of young people, I remember I was at a conference once and some young person was like horrified that I was talking about Bill Clinton's, you know, sort of aggressive cruise missile liberalism. You know, Clinton bombed a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. Clinton bombed Afghanistan. Clinton bombed Iraq. Clinton initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam in Iraq under the guise of the North and South no-fly zones. So it's not that Obama is some spectacularly awful Democrat on these issues. It's all a continuation. If you go back and look, Clinton passed the Omnibus Crime Bill or signed the Omnibus Crime Bill, the Effective Anti-Death Penalty Act, which was the precursor to the Patriot Act, made regime change in Iraq the official policy of the United States. So when Bush and those guys came into office, the conventional wisdom is that they did all of this. No, they actually did. They continued on with that spectrum. And I think that that's what Obama's doing, too. I do think he's a different guy than Cheney. I do think of Cheney as this evil character in his lair plotting the destruction of the world so Halliburton can make money. I don't think Obama is that. But I think what Obama is a typical hawkish Democratic president, the only kind that ever win those elections.
Jeremy Scahill is author of the new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And you can see him tonight at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, 2501 Harrison at 27th. He'll be speaking at 7:30. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How are moms organizing? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the authors of The Thinking Moms Revolution and activists with Moms Rising. In The Thinking Moms Revolution, a group of moms support each other to advocate for kids with autism. Moms Rising brings together millions of people who share a common concern about the need to build a more family-friendly country. So what are some success stories? What strategies are they using to further issues like maternity leave, healthcare, and fair wages? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.